From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is in recess, but that has not paused an intense debate among House Democrats about whether to impeach President Trump. Last night, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged her party to avoid it, but other Democrats say they have to at least initiate impeachment proceedings, even if the Republican-controlled Senate is unlikely to convict the president. Remember, an impeachment is just a trial, because House Democrats, some of them, say this is their constitutional duty. Mara Liasson is here. She's NPR's national political correspondent. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Robin.
And first, let's go back to fifth grade and remind ourselves why this is a House issue.
Impeachment is like an indictment. The House impeaches, and then it goes to the Senate, which acts like a jury, to decide whether or not to convict or remove the president.
Yeah. So
that's how it works.
That's how it works.
So even if the House impeached, that would mean they would indict the president. The Senate, because it's controlled by Republicans, would not remove him.
Right. So last night's conference call, Speaker Pelosi gathering her caucus together on the phone. What do you know about how that conversation went?
Well, Speaker Pelosi is not saying there should not be impeachment. What she's saying is we should not immediately open formal impeachment hearings. She's saying there are a lot of other ways to hold the president accountable. Some of those ways are already underway. Attorney General Barr is going to come up to the Hill to testify. So will Special Counsel Mueller. The House Judiciary Committee has already subpoenaed Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, to come up. There's a big fight now between House committees and the White House over the president's tax returns, his financial records. The person in the White House who is in charge of security clearances is refusing to come up and testify. So this is going to be a long process. There's going to be a lot of investigating of the president. Whether it leads to the kind of bipartisan consensus that Nancy Pelosi says is a prerequisite for impeachment, we don't know yet.
Yeah. Well, not long after her call, Senator Elizabeth Warren called for impeachment at that CNN town hall for presidential candidates. There are so many of them now on the Democratic side. They're doing them in batches. And Senator Kamala Harris was there as well, another presidential candidate, and she echoed Warren.
I believe that we need to get rid of this president. That's why I'm running for to become president of the United States. So that is part of the premise, obviously, of my point. But I think we have very good reason to believe that there is an investigation that has been conducted, which has produced evidence that tells us that this president and his administration engaged in obstruction of justice. I believe Congress should take the steps towards impeachment.
And she and other Democrats are pointing to things like the Mueller report saying that the president asked someone to, you know, stop the investigation. But then you have, people like Bernie Sanders seem to say, move on. What's your sense, Mara, of if this is going to be a 2020 campaign issue?
Bernie Sanders isn't saying move on. Bernie Sanders is saying he's afraid that impeachment would play into Donald Trump's hands,
right, yeah,
and be used as a way to rally the Republican base, and it would have a political backlash against Democrats. Look, inside the Democratic primary, people are using the impeachment issue either to stand out or to connect with parts of the Democratic base that wants impeachment. But it's not an ideological issue. Otherwise, the most leftist candidate, Bernie Sanders, would be for it. Mm. So it's more complicated.
Yeah.
I do think that Donald Trump and his advisors see it as a campaign issue because they would like to say that this is a purely partisan political exercise and the Democrats are trying to get him out of office because they won't accept his election. Mm-hmm. There are other Democrats who say, we're 18 months from an election. Let's let the voters decide whether Donald Trump should continue to be president or not.
Well, speaking of them, according to recent polling, this is the Morning Consult poll, a majority of Americans oppose impeachment, but a majority of Democrats support it. So is this Democrats looking at constituents?
In some cases, yes. But what was really interesting about that poll, even though 59% of Democrats said that they supported impeachment, that was down 12 points from the 71% of Democrats who said they supported impeachment back in January. Now, why the drop? It could be that more and more people are learning the civics lesson you started with, that, oh, impeachment isn't removal. Maybe they thought impeachment was the same thing as removal. Once they learn it isn't, they're not for it anymore. And also, a lot of Democrats would like to focus on health care and gun control and climate change, and they don't want impeachment to be a distraction
right
from that. But so right now, Democrats want it, but not as many as did a couple months ago.
Have you heard from any Republicans, even maybe off the record, so you wouldn't name them now, but who are saying, you know, maybe there is reason for impeachment. You know, maybe they do want somebody else in there.
I don't think there's any Republican who is for President Trump being impeached. I think there are some Republicans who think that if the House impeached him, it would be a political benefit to them.
Yeah.
But the president himself, who tweets a lot about impeachment,
yeah,
he doesn't want it to happen, but he definitely is worried about it. He's obsessed with it,
yep,
and rattled by it.
Mara Liasson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, today the Islamic State claimed responsibility for the series of bombings that killed more than 300 people at churches and hotels across Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday. Meanwhile, the Sri Lankan government has not said when it'll lift a ban on social media that it put in place after the attacks to stop the spread of what it called false news reports. For more on that part of the story, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is Recode's editor-at-large. Hi, Kara.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. And you write that when you heard that the Sri Lankan government temporarily blocked access to some social media sites like Facebook and YouTube after the bombings, your first thought was good. Why?
Well, you know, it's such an anathema to me that I said this, because a lot of the, you know, when the shutdowns happen of social media over the world, over the past decades, really now, you know, it's always an autocratic government that's trying to, you know, quelch dissent. And that's wrong. And I obviously am a journalist, and I'm not a First Amendment absolutist, but I certainly think that it's really important that these people have an ability to speak on these platforms. But what's happened is the people running these platforms and the companies that are running it have not taken enough responsibility for what's running over their platforms. And so they're not exactly free speech. They're just a cacophony of often malevolent and false information, and they're trying to stop it. But when you have issues of crisis, it creates a really problematic situation for governments, which are trying to calm things down, and the possibility of more violence.
What did the companies think about the fact that the sites were shut down in Sri Lanka?
Well, they made not that much noise. They said they really want to get back up because they're important to communications between the families and who are involved in the tragedy, and that's 100% true. In some of these countries, unlike the U.S., you know, Facebook is the de facto newspaper, it's the telephone system, it's the mail system. And so it becomes the everything system, and therefore is very, very liable to be abused by those who don't have good intent.
And there's history here in Sri Lanka, too. The government there has, yeah, actually blocked access to Facebook in the past when it thought posts were inciting anti-Muslim violence. This time,
yes,
they blocked before there was any evidence of any social media inspired,
right,
violence.
Right. And there was already stuff coming over it with, like, because this is a tit for tat. Like, I think this group has just said it's because of what happened in New Zealand, you know. And of course, New Zealand had its own issues. And that was a massive problem for sites like Facebook and YouTube, because, first of all, the shooter, this murderous man, used social media,
right,
to get his killings out. I mean, he was before, during, and after, essentially. And you can't blame, obviously, this killer is to blame. But the fact of the matter is, the internet was a critical, and social media was a critical part of his plan. And so, you know, New Zealand did not stop that, but they were certainly moving to hold these companies accountable, as are other countries.
Well, so do you think that this should be the go-to approach now when there's something like this,
no,
that the country should say, let's shut down the social media sites?
I think that where we've gotten is there's no other choice. Like, what can we do? Because they're certainly not policing these sites in the correct way. And maybe it's absolutely impossible. Maybe I believe they've architected them in a way that it's impossible, that, you know, for virality and growth. And, you know, the line I had was, when you traffic in outrage, you get death. And so if that's the case, you either stop trafficking in outrage or you shut it down. And unfortunately, shutting it down does work, if only temporarily.
Do you think, though, that we're reaching some kind of a tipping point now? I feel like these days, when we're talking to you or other people at Recode, or we're talking about tech news in general, it's, mm-hmm, almost always about something bad that the social media sites,
right,
are doing, or maybe that they're just involved in and they had nothing to do with, but something like this.
Well, you know, they are involved in this. It's just, you know, the ability for they have knocked the lid off of controls of anything. And that's great for regular people to be able to talk to each other and for the more benign uses of these platforms, which are wonderful. But the fact of the matter is they have allowed false players on these platforms, malevolent players who are using propaganda, who are using, you know, bots, whatever it is, whether it's infecting the U.S. elections or elections somewhere else, whether it's fomenting hatred somewhere, whether it's creating rumors that aren't true. These have real life impact. And I think these people who architect these things did not think clearly enough about what happens when that happens. And there's all kinds of things regulators can do, certainly, either fining them or holding them liable for this content or shutting it down. And so we don't want to get to the shutdown period. And I just interviewed Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. She's got her hands full with a lot of other things, obviously. But one of the issues is Section 230, for example, the Communications Decency Act of the United States, which gives these platforms broad immunity for what flows over their platforms. She called it a gift that they've been abusing. You know, that's mm-hmm. like, hey, pay attention. There can be regulations all over the world. Whatever it is, it's coming for them. And so they have to really think hard about what that means and how they can rein in some of the worst parts of these platforms.
It's Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode. Kara, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
We're offering all the presidential candidates running in 2020 a chance to come on the show and talk with us. Today, John Hickenlooper, former governor of Colorado and Democratic presidential candidate. Governor, welcome to Here and Now.
Glad to be on, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start with what's been in the news the last several days, which is the Mueller report. How big an issue would you make this if you're the nominee in 2020?
Well, I think it's obviously a large issue no matter where you are as a citizen of America. I mean, take the facts that no one's arguing about. The Trump campaign welcomed the assistance of a hostile foreign power to interject themselves and try and change the outcome of our elections. That, to me, that's unthinkable. And then, of course, they lied about it. And then they took steps to prevent the truth from coming out. So, and we should expect more from our commander-in-chief.
Do you think the Democrats should push for impeachment?
Well, I think the key things that we need to focus on first, I think, is that we have to really push for an unredacted copy of the report that goes to Congress. I think Mr. Mueller should testify in front of Congress. And then we can see in gory detail and in high contrast color more clearly what went on and make a decision about impeachment.
You are a former geologist for an oil and gas company. You co-founded a brewery in 1988. You became the mayor of Denver, then governor of the state of Colorado. What would be your single biggest priority if you become president of the United States?
Well, you know, I'm running for president because I think we're in a national crisis of division. I don't think we've been this divided since the Civil War. And it's preventing us from dealing with some of these really big challenges, the incredible inflation for healthcare costs over the last 30 years, the way the entire workplace is going to be disrupted by artificial intelligence and automation, climate change. We are rapidly approaching a point of irreversible damage to our planet, and yet somehow we're not able to even find the smallest common ground.
What would you do on the issue of climate change? I know that in the past, because of your support of fracking, there are some environmentalists who've called you Frackin' Looper.
Yeah. The problem isn't fracking. And I understand why people want to get out of hydrocarbons immediately, but most of those people are still driving automobiles. What we've done in Colorado, and I'd hold our record up against any other state, we were able to get the oil and gas industry and the environmental community to sit down and negotiate what we call methane regulations. But, you know, methane is 25 to 40 times worse for climate change than carbon dioxide. So we ended up getting the oil and gas industry to pay $60 million a year to address these fugitive emissions of methane. We've just in the process still now of closing two coal-fired electrical generation plants in southern Colorado, replacing them with wind, solar, and for the first time in the country, batteries.
Do you think that in the future there should be a point at which the U.S., the goal of the United States, is to have no more power coming from oil and gas in any way?
Well, at some point we want to get to as clean an energy system as possible. And that's going to require all kinds of innovations, some of which we've never even seen to this day. It'll take a while before we are completely free of all hydrocarbons. Let's be brutally honest. I don't see any way that could possibly ever happen by 2030. But I do share the urgency that we've got to make that transition much more rapidly than what we're seeing take place today.
You know, it doesn't get the headlines that some of these other issues get, but the leading cause of death in the United States for men and women is heart disease, according to the CDC. 1 in 4 people die of it. What would you do, or is there anything that you would do as president to deal with obesity and heart disease?
Oh, absolutely. And I think our system rewards when you have a medical crisis. That's when hospitals and doctors and pharmaceutical companies, that's when they get paid a lot of money. There's no great economic reward for the system if we convince citizens to avoid or change their lifestyle so they don't become vulnerable for heart attacks, if they don't have high blood pressure. So we need to change that whole system. One thing we've done in Colorado is really promote aggressively outdoor recreation, get more people walking, more people hiking. We've got to bring exercise back into elementary and middle and high schools. There's got to be a recess. We've got to become more active. And instead, we're going just the opposite direction. You know, the big financial incentive for our system is to get kids to spend more time looking in their cell phones. That's not healthy at all.
What do you think of the idea of Medicare for all when it comes to health care?
Well, I believe in universal coverage, and I think we have to provide a public option of some sort. And maybe that'll be Medicare or some combination of Medicare and Medicare Advantage. Could also be expanding Medicaid. But I don't think – I mean, there are roughly 160 million people that get their health care coverage through private insurance, most of it through their workplace. So I don't think we're going to take – I don't see government prying away the health care insurance that people are happy with from 80, 100, 120 million people. So if we provide a public option, and that is Medicare or Medicare Advantage or some combination, and Medicare grows and its scale, its costs go down, it becomes what everybody chooses, and then we evolve into Medicare for all, but it's an evolution, it's not a revolution. Mm.
How much time in your life have you spent outside the United States?
Oh, a fair amount. You know, when I was young, I was I wouldn't say obsessed, but I spent a lot of time in Latin America. When I was a graduate student as a geologist, I worked in Costa Rica for about 10 months. I've always been someone who explores new territories, and most of that's been in Latin America, but I've also been multiple times to Japan and Israel and Europe, Asia. You learn about your own culture by immersing yourself in other cultures.
And when it comes to foreign policy, China is the world's second largest economy now. We're in a trade war with China at the moment. Do you think that the U.S. should actively try and stop China from becoming the largest economy, the largest military power in the world? And if so, how?
Well, let me first say that China was cheating on agreements. China was stealing intellectual property from American companies. I think we needed to address that. That being said, getting into a trade war, you know, in that trade war, we've in many ways have withdrawn from all of our international agreements. We're allowing China to have an open field in South America, in Africa, in Central Asia. And they are now making investments in infrastructure and building relationships that we're going to regret deeply. I mean, China is so large, both geographically and by population. Ultimately, slowly, they will become larger than the United States. We have to make sure that as they grow, we understand and are able to help shape that growth so that long term, we have a vision of how we can coexist and not be rivals and not get to the brink of military engagement. I think what President Trump has created with the trade war is pushing us to situations where we do get closer to armed conflict.
You've referred to yourself as an extreme moderate. have you ever voted for a Republican for president?
I have not voted for a Republican for president, although I can say with a straight face and true honesty, I feel that I've always voted for the best person. You know, I always tell this funny story that all my grandparents, all my aunts and uncles were all Republicans. But my mother was widowed twice before she turned 40 years old. And she thought government maybe should be smaller, but the government had to work. And she raised 4 Democrats.
Speaking of your family, I want to ask you one more thing, which is that your father died when you were very young. How much of an impact did that have on who you are today?
Well, my father was a great raconteur. He loved telling stories. He was an engineer. So he was a person comfortable with numbers and economics. I've gotten so much of who I am from him, but he got cancer when I was, I think I was 4.5 or 5. So I don't have that many memories of him, but he died just after I turned 8. Mm-hmm. And his vacuum, his absence was something I never could identify, but it was there. And it certainly created in me an empathy. I felt marginalized in many ways, and I became very empathetic with other people that were the kids in school that didn't fit in as well socially with everybody else. I was the kid in my class that tried to be friends with everybody. And in that process, I think I learned how to listen to people better. You know, my mother told us when we were kids, you can't control what life throws at you, right? You can't, what terrible things come, you can't control. But you can control how you respond, whether it makes you stronger or weaker.
So, Governor Hickenlooper, as you look forward to this campaign, where are you going to be focusing most of your efforts?
Well, Colorado has a special relationship with Iowa. We have so many people in Colorado that have moved here from Iowa or come here for a few years and then go back to Iowa. So we're going to spend a lot of time in Iowa, and I think a lot of time in New Hampshire, just because my mother grew up in the Depression. She never bought a dress. She sewed everything for most of her life. She never bought a dress. And I think New Hampshire has that same sense of frugality in many places. So I think who I am will fit in well with how New Hampshireites feel about who they are.
That is John Hickenlooper, the former governor of Colorado and now a Democrat running for president. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much, Jeremy. I appreciate it.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, EmberWave. EmberWave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. EmberWave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave. Control your comfort.
According to an annual report from the government that's out this week, Social Security will run out of money in 2035, Medicare 2026. That means if Congress doesn't act, future retirees would only get 3/4 of their scheduled benefits from Social Security. And so far, reaching a solution has been very difficult for Democrats and Republicans, who differ sharply over how best to reform programs that are a lifeline for many Americans. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this is a report that comes out every year, and every year we have the same discussion about the fact that these programs are in real trouble in the not too distant future. Is anyone going to do anything as a result of this report?
So, you know, it's not the forefront of most discussions. There are definitely other election seasons where you hear Social Security being discussed, but there is a fairly active caucus in the House and the Senate, mostly Democrats, who are trying to deal with this. Here's the problem is that in 2020, there's going to be more money paid out of Social Security than brought in. Now, the good news is that was supposed to happen in 2018. It hasn't happened since 1982. The bad news is, as you go further out, there's a trust fund to cover these shortfalls like we're going to have in 2020, but that trust fund will be exhausted in about 15 years. And at that point, either Congress has to do something to increase the amount of money in the trust fund, or people, as you just described, will get less money. This is a very big problem for people at the lower end of the income scale who don't have 401ks, who don't have pensions, and for whom Social Security is kind of all of the money they have in retirement.
Right. We know that most people in this country do not have near the amount of retirement savings that they are told by experts that they should have. So Social Security becomes a real lifeline.
That's correct. And, you know, according to the Fed, the number of U.S. workers, the share of U.S. workers who are covered by traditional employer-sponsored pension plans, as we know, has been declining dramatically for the past few decades. A lot of that's shifted to 401ks. But remember how much of our economy is part-time, contract, and gig, where there isn't any retirement spending. So, and again, it completely correlates to how much money you have. For those people under 50 who are in the middle quartile of income, the middle 50%, Social Security is going to amount to between 50 and 65% of their total retirement wealth. But for the bottom 25%, Social Security will be all of their retirement wealth. And that's going to be a big problem if in 15 years it's not able to pay out what it's, you know, what it's supposed to.
Okay, we could spend a whole hour on what each side wants to do about this problem. So what I want to ask you instead is any country that's dealing with an aging population, has anybody figured out a good solution to this?
Not a good solution, but keep in mind in Canada and the UK and in Northern European countries, a lot of other expenses are taken care of because of social structure. So in the years leading up to retirement, you're not paying out as much in health care or in education costs for your kids. But, you know, China's pension fund is going to be insolvent by 2035. Germany, Austria, France, they also spend a high percentage on retirement and disability like Medicaid, things like that. No, it's just that the U.S., like in healthcare, pays more of its GDP for this than other countries do.
A very large percent.
Yeah, very large percent.
That is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, I'm sure they'll have this figured out by the time this report comes out next year. Thanks so much.
When you think of racial injustice, you may think of housing or the criminal justice system, but there's also an environmental justice movement a few decades old now, born out of studies showing communities of color and poor whites are more likely to also be home to hazardous waste sites and landfills. In 1990, the EPA began looking at the environment through the lens of race and class. President George H.W. Bush created an Office of Environmental Justice at the EPA to listen to local concerns, funnel grant money into local projects. President Clinton declared environmental injustice a violation of the Civil Rights Act. That thinking stalled in the George W. Bush administration, picked up again under President Obama, but now President Trump's fiscal year 2020 proposed budget would cut EPA funding by 31%, the biggest cut of any federal agency. Dr. Robert Bullard has been watching this history and is a part of it. He's now a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas Southern University. Now, in a few minutes, we're going to go micro and hear from an environmental justice or environmental racism activist in St. James, Louisiana. But we start with Dr. Bullard. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you are often described as the father of environmental justice. I would say that maybe they should add your wife as the mother there, too, because part of this started for you in the 1970s when she was bringing a lawsuit and asked you to help.
That's correct. I was asked to collect data for a lawsuit that she had filed that was challenging the location of a municipal landfill in a predominantly black middle-class community here in Houston. And I had 10 students in my research methods class at Texas Southern University, and we did that study in 1979.
And you went on to find that 5 out of 5 landfills in Houston were in black neighborhoods, 6 out of 8 incinerators in black neighborhoods. I mean, the stats just kept coming.
Well, you know, you can't get any more perfect than 5 out of 5.
Right.
That's batting 1,000.
Right.
What we found is that over 40 years, from the 30s up until 1978, 82% of all the garbage dumped in Houston was dumped in black neighborhoods.
And do I understand you went more broadly? You found city-owned smelters located in black and brown neighborhoods in Dallas, Alabama, the largest hazardous waste facility in a town that was 95% black. Explain why historically this happened. I mean, we understand our history and we understand the segregation of people of color in impoverished areas. But it also has to do with power, that usually these areas are run by white politicians.
Well, if you look at the case of Houston, it was a black middle-class neighborhood of homeowners. And if you talk about where locally unwanted land uses, such as landfills, incinerators, they generally follow the path of least resistance. And historically, African Americans in the South were not given the right to vote. They couldn't voice their opposition in a way that would influence stopping these facilities. And so it was a pattern that's tantamount to environmental racism.
Well, then, as you continue on, again, if people are living in areas and their politicians, the people making decisions about that area, are not living there or are maybe not truly representing them, they may end up, as you said, with these decisions being made somewhere else about where they live.
That's correct. And it was in 1991 when Dr. Benjamin Chavis at the United Church of Christ pulled together a dozen of us to plan the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And we developed 17 principles of environmental justice at that summit in 91. And the first principle was that people must speak for themselves. Now, yeah. That's only fair, just, and equitable.
So what do you think has to happen now, specifically when it comes to environmental injustice?
Well, when we look at the assaults on environmental regulations and protection, it's basically an assault on all of us. And I think climate change is one of those things that really make this real. And yeah. So we have to all work on these issues.
Well, Dr. Bullard, I got to ask you. Everyone, white, black, brown, is now threatened by climate change. I wonder if there's a part of you saying, well, you know, if you only hadn't written it off as a problem just, you know, for blacks and people of color and the poor.
Well, you know, this whole idea of finding out discovery and translating that information so that people can see it for themselves, it's like very few people are arguing with whether or not they believe in gravity. Gravity is not something that you believe in. It's real. What keeps me going in this movement is the fact that every social movement that has been successful has had strong youth and student components. That, to me, gives me hope and also makes sure that it keeps us optimistic.
Dr. Robert Bullard, a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas Southern University. Doctor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Let's bring in Travis London now, a member of Rise St. James, a community advocacy group fighting pollutants from oil and gas industries in St. James, Louisiana. Activism is something he kind of fell into. Family members worked for Dow Chemical. He's concerned about an expanding CF Industries ammonia plant. He also opposed the Bayou Bridge pipeline, which cuts through parts of Louisiana. And Travis, I understand you are right smack in the middle of this 85-mile stretch. They are known as Cancer Alley.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. This runs from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, and it's got something like 150 plants and refineries. Look, you and others fought the BioBridge pipeline. You had some successes. There was a stay. But ultimately, the construction was approved by a judge. Does that feel like you and others have failed because the pipeline was built?
Oh, not necessarily in a sense, because we brought a bigger coalition and raised a lot of awareness in regards to pipelines, of how unsafe they really are compared to any other transportation of oil and gas. And we show how it's a bigger environmental impact with those incidents rather than the ones on the roads.
In other words, more incidents from pipelines than incidents carrying the same kind of product in trucks on the road.
Yes, ma'am. Because see, when the oil is spilled from the pipeline to the water system, that's definitely hard to clean up. You got various incidents across the United States with the same people that did the Bayou Bridge pipeline that spilled some oil in Ohio and Pennsylvania and stuff like that that were hard to clean up.
Look, there's a lot of statistics to back up just how much pollution, hazardous material there is there in Cancer Alley where you are. But what do you say to people who say building a pipeline produces jobs, having plants produces jobs?
Most of the times, the jobs that they do have, they often normally give it to people out of state rather than in state. And they will not have that same sentimental value for our community like we do.
Yeah. Well, Travis London, you've got four kids, and I'm sure you're worried about their health. Some would say, why don't you move?
Well, I still believe that my community could still be saved. So I brought the attention to my town about CF Industries being the largest ammonia producing plant in the world. So they're really like trying to focus on creating fertilizer with ammonia. So they kind of sound like the crazy deaf cousin of Monsanto.
You're saying you brought attention to a plant with the ammonia industry kind of flagging a little bit. They're turning to fertilizer, you're saying, and that's, you're even more concerned about that.
And they also produce plastics in Oregon. So with the big old plane expansion, we don't even know for sure if they even making some of the stuff for plastics in that same plant.
We know you organized a memorial for people in your area who passed away from cancer. Do you know a lot of people? And are you able to draw a line from these cancers to living in Cancer Alley?
Yes, man. I got my own family, for instance. My grandfather, his name was Alfred Watts. He was working for Dow. He died from asbestos and was turned cancerous. He died in 2001 or two.
And this was asbestos poisoning?
Yes, ma'am. And I had my Head Start teacher. She died from cancer. And they had three other people in my community that were close to that died last year pertaining to cancer, which kind of hurt me.
Well, so what are you fighting now, Travis? What was your goal now?
Well, my goal now is that what I do is I join a lot of different organizations. I make sure that people understand that water is needed for anything that you do, because some companies have benzene that goes into the water. Benzene is known for being a chemical that mess with the mitochondria, which give kids all low cognitive skills.
To make sure I've heard you, you're saying that there's a facility that's washing things with the chemical benzene, but then that goes into the water system, and then kids drink that, and you've made the connection between that and their cognitive abilities, their thinking, and so this is information that you are trying to bring to people.
Yes, man. I show people how water could bring about, like, the different issues when they pollute it.
Yeah. Travis London, again, a member of Rise St. James, the community advocacy group, in Louisiana. Travis, we wish you the best of luck there, and thanks so much for talking to us about it.
And thank you, too, for inviting me to talk with y'all about it.
French filmmaker Claire Denis has been making movies for more than 30 years, and for most of that time, they've been scored by an alternative British band called Tindersticks. Their latest collaboration is called High Life. It's an outer space fable, and it's also Denis' first film in English. Tim Grieving reports that the movie is finally bringing the filmmaker and her collaborators some mainstream love.
In the summer of 1995, Claire Denis had just written the script for Nanette and Bonnie, a coming-of-age film about a brother and sister, and she wanted to use a song called My Sister by Tindersticks.
Because I've been writing the script, listening to my sister every day.
You remember my sister? How many mistakes did she make with those never-blinking eyes?
So Denis went to see Tindersticks at a concert in Paris, and she found bandleader Stuart Staples backstage after the show.
And Stuart tell me, it's so sad to give you the right to use a song. Let's do the complete score. Let's share more.
She burned down the house when she was 10. I was away camping with the scout. The fireman said she'd been smoking in bed. The old story, I told you.
The musicians had never done a film score before, says Stuart Staples, who co-founded Tindersticks in 1991 out of a band called Asphalt Ribbons with keyboard player David Bolter.
When we were young, we had kind of film scoring pretensions, I suppose. And when I first met David in the band, this was in Nottingham in the mid-80s, he had reference points like John Barry, and I think David kind of educated us about film music.
But actually exchanging ideas with filmmaker Claire Denis proved to be a challenge at first.
Stuart comes from the north of England, and my English, because I'm French, he could not understand. So for years, we kept talking to each other, saying yes, yes, oh yes, yes, yes. We were, like, understanding each other without words.
Their Morse code worked. Staples and his bandmates have scored 8 of Denis' films, from the sort of vampire story Trouble Every Day to the romance Let the Sunshine In. Music is a perfect match for the mood of Denis' films, says Oscar-winning Moonlight director Barry Jenkins, who's a big fan of the Denis-Tindersticks collaboration.
There's this depiction of Claire as this very austere, cold, art house director who makes these very quiet films, and yet her films have very lush, very rich, very involved scores. But the scores work because they're not trying to tell you what to feel. They're amplifying the feeling the characters are already exhibiting.
The music is not there to emphasize emotional stuff, you know? Music is there to be like another voice in the film.
The original Tindersticks broke up in 2006, but Stuart Staples kept scoring Denis' films. Their latest collaboration, High Life, is a grim story set on board a spacecraft full of criminals who are part of an experiment. Robert Pattinson plays one of them, who's raising his infant daughter on the ship. Composer Stuart Staples says he started imagining enclosed spaces, and that was his jumping-off point for the score. He brought musicians into his studio and tried to capture their instruments reverberating in that space.
I was also interested in this idea of kind of a random music, music that is not composed.
There is a composed song, however, that Robert Pattinson's character sings to his daughter.
Willow, where are you hiding now?
Pattinson has sung in films before, but this time he channeled his inner Stuart Staples.
Literally, I would get Stuart to sing each line just before I sang it, and I would try my best to imitate his Midlands accent.
Willow, do you walk across the sand?
I recognize Stuart in that song, you know?
Writer-director Claire Denis.
The way he made a song for a beloved daughter, I think Stuart is such a poet of love, you know?
Of course, a few minutes earlier, Denis also said,
I have to trust him because I'm afraid of Stuart. It's very difficult to say no to him because he's fierce, you know? He's a frightening guy.
Who, Denis says, sometimes understands her scripts better than she does. For NPR News, I'm Tim Grieving in Los Angeles.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.